This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway this week is the comedian, actor and writer Jack Whitehall. He's done a lot quite quickly. Award-winning stand-up, sitcoms and panel shows. And in a job where upper-middle-class privilege could be a distinct disadvantage, he's made it his gilt-edged calling card. Even his hair looks posh. He's not quite 30 yet, but he's been at it for a good long while. His first professional acting job was at 3 years old. But then his father, Michael, was a theatrical agent and his mother, an actress. Although connections and coaching have far from guaranteed success, his audition, aged 11, for the movie role of Harry Potter was something of a low point. Lately, he's been part of an unlikely double act, teaming up for a TV chat show and travelogues with his dad. It shouldn't really work, but it does. He says, "I was a show-off in class, always fooling and pranking around. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was a bit of an odd fit. What's so weird is the minute you find an outlet where you can go on stage and make people laugh, you suddenly settle as a person." So welcome, Jack Whitehall. You look a bit terrified.
I look settled.
Okay.
I'm worried because any time I do any kind of like grown-up interview, I always read it back and I'm like, wow, this guy sounds suicidal. I sound so depressed whenever I talk about myself, so I'm going to be conscious of not.
Okay, well, there is a difference, of course, from a print interview. People can hear the tone of your voice, so they can hear when you're being funny. And obviously, we pride ourselves in our unimpeachable standards here at Desert Island Discs. We will not misrepresent you in any way. So you do, as I alluded to there, you do lots of stuff. You write for TV, you exec produce, you perform, you do stand-up. Which is the one that feels most natural to you to do?
I think that nothing really beats that excitement of being on stage and the immediacy of it and saying something and an audience reacting. But whenever people ask me what I prefer, I always say it's whatever you're not doing. So whenever you're on tour and you're doing stand-up and you're loving it, within a couple of months you're like, I wish I was locked away in a room with just one person writing some stuff. So you're never really truly happy because the grass is always greener.
With stand-up, of course, the general temperature of stand-up these days is the kind of everyman. And of course, when you got up on stage, you were not like most people because, well, you were a bit posh and you have turned that into your unique selling point. How long was it before you realised that actually I just have to come clean on this one?
Oh, quite a long time. And there were various incarnations of early me on stage, which were as varied as me going on and literally talking like I was Danny Dyer. There's some footage on the internet of me in the early days and I'm talking like that. And my dad was horrified. He's like, why do you keep dropping all of your consonants? Why did I send you to school and you go on and you embarrass me like this? And I also thought, oh, I should go on wearing a jacket, a big Parker jacket, like one of the characters from South Park. And I did these deadpan jokes. I did a poet as well. One gig was enough to realise that that was not the direction to go in either. That's the most frustrating thing when you start doing stand-up, though. Other comedians, critics, they always say, you have something there, but you need to find your voice. And you're like, well, what is my voice? Can you tell me what my voice is? But you have to go on this kind of journey to find your voice.
Can you sing?
I can't sing.
Didn't you sing on your chat show, Back Chat?
I did sing. I sung with Michael Ball. No, I can't sing, but I have sung. And I sung recently on a job that I did.
Yes, in which case. Tell me about your first track then. What are we going to hear today? Why have you chosen this?
I recently played Mark Bolan in a one-off for Sky about when Mark Bolan and David Bowie met when they were younger. And I had to sing with Luke Treadway, who's got a wonderful voice, and I do not have a wonderful voice, so I had to have someone in my ear singing the song and I would sing it back, because I can sing it when I'm hearing someone else singing it directly into my ear.
Okay.
Then I can carry a tune.
I moved
T-Rex and 20th Century Boy. So, Jack Whitehall, you've started doing a lot more serious acting these days. In 2016, you starred in Evelyn Waugh's Decline and Fall. Quite a cast alongside you. Eva Longoria from Desperate Housewives, Douglas Hodge, David Suchet. Such a different environment from doing stand-up, of course. Has that been quite a step change for you, getting used to that?
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of terrifying doing stuff to silence and not knowing whether it's working. And even at the end of the day, you don't know whether it was good or not. And you go home and you're like, oh, I could have done that better. And am I rubbish? So there's a lot of worry attached to it. And when you go out and you do stand up, you know whether it's worked in the night. And that's hard to make that transition.
Stand up is such a risky business, isn't it? It always fascinates me with comics, what it is that propels somebody up onto that lonely stage. What was it that propelled you up there?
I just love making people laugh, even if it was just in conversation. And so to be able to go on and do that to a room full of strangers was like a kind of drug. And the minute I went up on stage for the first time, I was like, I will always have to do this because I love it.
Would you have been, maybe not so much now, but when you were a bit younger at least, if you were out at the pub, would you have been the person in the group who was entertaining people? Did you feel the need to sort of keep the laugh in the air and be liked by a group of people?
Yes, I think so. Yes, definitely. I was the sort of clown. But as you mentioned sort of briefly at the top, you know, the minute you go on stage and you start performing and you have that outlet for it, you stop doing that. And then also your friends are so conscious of it. So now if I'm trying to be funny when I'm out with my friends, they're like, mate, you're not on stage now. And they instantly put you down. So it's quite hard to then be funny in real life.
Tell me about your second piece of music, Jack Whitehall. What are we going to hear?
My second piece of music is a song that reminds me of my childhood. And it reminds me of me and my brother and sister jumping around on my dad's bed, all wearing matching pyjamas, singing into a hairbrush. And this was a song that he loves, Nat King Cole, Let There Be Love.
Let there be you, let there be me, let there be oysters under the sea, let there be wind, an occasional rain, chili con carne, sparkling champagne.
That was Nat King Cole and Let There Be Love. You said, Jack Whitehall, during that music playing that you'd chosen it for wonderful family memories, they sound like, but also because that was the thing your father would listen to, yeah. But he would also listen to, what else did you say?
Well, the other option for the father-based track was The Plain Chant of the Monks from Ampleforth, which was the other thing that he would play on loop, which I can appreciate now, but as a seven-year-old child, is not necessarily the kind of music that you would go to.
Is it true that Nigel Havers was in the delivery room in evening suit when you made your way into the world?
Yep, that's how I entered
so
the world,
that's true.
Nigel Havers.
Right, explain yourself. How
in
come?
In a dinner jacket.
Yeah.
Well, he'd been trying on a dinner jacket at Piero di Monzi, and my mother was taken to hospital, and my father, who was best friends with Nigel Havers and his agent, called him up and said, oh, the baby's coming, and Nigel arrived in his dinner jacket. But also, the gynaecologist that was delivering me had been that night speaking at a gynaecological convention.
Right.
And so he was also in a dinner jacket. So I was delivered by a man in a dinner jacket.
Were you
Nigel
in a dinner
Havers
jacket?
There, also in a dinner jacket. Yeah, they put me straight into a dinner jacket. So that was how I entered the world. And I think it set the tone.
How did your parents, how did they meet? Your mum, Hilary, your dad, Michael.
They met because my mother was a young actress and she wanted an agent. And my father was an agent who wanted a wife. So she came to meet him just because she was looking for representation, and they met and they fell in love and then they got married.
Your dad then was in his late 40s, I think, when you were born. You were their first child. Your dad has said in the past that it was something of an advantage, he thought, being an older parent. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it had its advantages in that, you know, when we were younger, he'd sort of retired. So he was a present father and really focused on his family. I think a lot of my love of comedy comes from him and watching old Laurel and Hardy films and things like that. He has always had a very dry sense of humour and has always been very witty and funny. And you'd see him entertain people. And I definitely think I looked up to him and thought, oh, I'd like to do that one day.
You do those brilliant sort of moments where you kind of can't believe he said what he said on screen. Do you know what's coming, or are you genuine? Are those moments of genuine surprise and sometimes horror?
Yeah, I think sometimes I'm genuinely shocked by what he says. I mean, you can prepare yourself for a lot of it and you're ready to excuse him and apologize on his behalf, but every now and again he will just sidestep you with something outrageous.
What can you think of the worst one where you've been absolutely dumbfounded?
Sometimes you write a routine and you have to embellish it, and sometimes you write a routine, something just comes to you and it's like gift wrapped and perfect and ready and you can just repeat it. And one of my first routines and one of my favorite routines is directly something that he said, which was that we were watching the news together as a family, and then it was a report about Robert Mugabe, and my dad was ranting and raving at the television, and in a kind of moment of like lapse, he dropped the C-bomb in front of my mum at the kitchen table, and my mum went absolutely berserk. She was like, how dare you use that word? You can't say that in front of my babies. I was like 16 at the time, but you know what mums are like. She's like, how dare you? Can't use that horrible word in this house. And my dad turned to my mum, and I always remember he went, this is typical of you, Hillary. You are always defending Mugabe. I was like, what? Where does that come from in your... So that was, yeah, that was like one of the first times I spoke about my dad on stage, and I repeated that story, and it's just verbatim. That's exactly as it happened.
Let's have your third piece of music, Jack White. Well, tell me about this then. What are we going to hear now?
This song is the theme from E.T. I love music scores. I saw E.T. at the Royal Albert Hall with a live orchestra last year. It was amazing. This is John Williams' theme from E.T.
Flying from the film E.T., composed by John Williams. So, Jack Whitehall, as I mentioned, you made your TV debut when you were just 3 years old. You were in something called The Good Guys, that starred Nigel Havers, in fact.
Yeah, I wonder how I got that gig.
Yeah, I wonder. I've seen a remarkably beautiful picture of you dressed up as a Tudor lady at Hampton Court Palace when you were a little boy. And you did love dressing up as a little kid.
Yeah, I was obsessed with dressing up. I would dress up as Robin Hood all the time, to like everything. Like family functions.
Were you one of those kids that turned up and people were just like, yeah,
yeah, he's in tights.
Yeah.
Made my mum make me a Power Ranger outfit and I wore that all the time. Yeah. I mean, they must have been quite worried.
Did you, your dad?
That I wanted to be other people. But I guess
yes, you wanted to be other people.
I wanted to be other people. There was a stage when I loved Thunderbirds so much and I wanted my mum to make me look like Scott Tracy. And if she couldn't get my hair to look like Scott Tracy before I went to school, then I would cry. And she was like, it's a puppet. I can't make your hair look like a puppet. She'd be spraying it and gelling it and trying to get it to look like Scott Tracy's. No wonder they wanted me to go off and act. It was a, you know, a day off.
But your dad didn't want you to dance. And what was his problem? Because that's all sort of part of the same thing, isn't it, of performing?
My sister was doing ballet. I was like, well, why can't I do ballet? So I went and did ballet, and he didn't think that that's what boys should do. So he then made me do karate.
And how did that go?
Not great. I probably should have taken the tutu off before I started the lesson. So quite an exuberant child. And then, but
did you have a surfeit of energy? Were you sort of one of those kids who was kind of bouncing off the walls?
Yes, but I was a really sweet kid and I looked like a little cherub. And then I went to boarding school 13-14 and I got very awkward, had glasses, buck teeth, terrible acne, and I suddenly became that awkward adolescent.
I do want to ask you about this Harry Potter audition. I don't know how much of it is embellished to make us laugh, but you were 11 and you seriously were going for the big audition.
Yeah.
And you went in full costume, did you?
I didn't go in full costume. That's the embellishment. But I looked like Harry Potter and they did an open audition at my school. And my dad was like, that's a complete waste of time. No one ever gets cast from those kind of things. So I have some contacts. Here's where the nepotism kicks in. I can get you in the door and you'll go to the casting director's house and you'll have a one-on-one with her. So I went there and I did it, but I hadn't read the book. And there was a lot of questions about the book in the audition. And obviously, having not read it, I slightly let myself down and didn't get the part. obviously.
obviously. We know that.
That bit you know. Yeah, that bit you know. So, yeah.
What did your parents say to you afterwards?
They were absolutely fine. They realised that it was a long shot. I say, when I've talked about it before, that they were devastated, but they, you know, they were very supportive when things didn't work.
Tell me about your fourth disc. What are we going to hear, Jack Whitehall?
My fourth tune is from a cassette tape that my mum had called Mundo Latino. And I always remember she used to play it on the long car journeys back to school. Those car journeys back to school, the two memories that I have are this and The Archers, because she listens to The Archers religiously. Like, doing this show, Desert Island Discs, is the most excited she's been for anything that I've ever done. The text that I got this morning, she was like, I am so proud of you that you're doing Desert Island Discs. The only thing that could top that was if I had, like, a walk-on part in The Archers. But I have this weird thing with The Archers where I remember getting really car sick and listening to The Archers. Whenever I hear The Archers theme tune, I feel a little bit sick.
You might not be the only person that happens to.
I know. Anyway, the Gypsy Kings, Bambaleo.
Ese amor llega así, esta manera. No tiene la culpa. Caballo le dan sabana, porque muy despreciado. Por eso no te perdono llorar. Ese amor llega así, esta manera, no tiene la culpa. Amor de compraventa, amor del de pasado. Ven, 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 ven. Bamboleo, bamboleo.
Gypsy Kings, Bambaleo. Your dad has written, Jack Whitehall, that I thought a boarding school education might help to straighten him out, him being you, of course. What was it that needed straightening, do you think?
That sounds like him trying to be funny.
Right.
Well, my school in London, I was bottom of my class, really struggle reading. I had, like, lots of learning support. Am I dyslexic? I don't know. I think if I was tested now, I would be dyslexic.
How old were you when you were sent to boarding school?
I was 11. I remember when they told me. I just remember being in my mum and dad's bathroom just, like, in floods of tears. And they were like, yeah, you're going to boarding school. And I was like, but I don't want to leave all of my friends behind. And it's going to be horrible. And I was terrified. And, you know, my dad was great. He was like, you're going to be fine. And if you don't like it after a term, you can come back.
And did you like it?
I did like it. And also subsequently, he told me that was a complete lie, that I was there and that I was staying there.
Did it harden you up a bit? I mean, did you have to form a kind of a carapace, you know, to deal with it? Because you were clearly a smart, sensitive, creative boy.
Yeah, I think that was where it was good, is that I went to a school that really encouraged creativity and celebrated it. And I could go and do plays, and at that point I was obsessed with art. I loved drawing and painting, and that was all sort of celebrated, whereas at my school that I was at before, they didn't really know what to do with me.
There are many people, of course, who rail against the 7% who are privately educated, you know, the elite that they feel still get a leg up into so many of our institutions. I'm wondering, just as a young kid, if you were aware that you were part of a very small and select group of people in Britain.
I don't think you are. And you don't realise how charmed your life is. You don't fully understand what that elite is until you leave. And then I think some people just choose not to care, and other people, you get a sort of swelling sense of it's kind of guilt, I guess. At the time, you're like complaining, you're like, oh, this lunch is rubbish. You have like three different options and a baked potato bar and a salad buffet. You're living in this bubble.
The public school that you went on to was Marlborough College. This sort of slight upper middle class guilt that you've spoken about, having gone through the public school system, was there a moment when it very forcibly hit you?
I don't think it was a sudden thing. I think it's just a sort of gradual thing, and you're like, it's unfair, and you can't not consciously think it's ridiculous that some schools have no, like, sports fields, and I went to a school that had a beagling lodge. Like, that doesn't really... And that's true. It had a beagling lodge. Like,
were there beagles in it?
Yes. I mean, that's silly. But at the time, I wasn't stupid enough to think that every school had a beagling lodge. But you're like, there's some discrepancy.
It's time for some more music. Tell me about this next one. It's your fifth of the morning, Jack.
This is a song that reminds me of Manchester, where I was at university for about 5 minutes. I got very into dance music. And this was my entry point. New Order, Blue Monday.
Level dance music, as you described it, Jack Whitehall. That was New Order and Blue Monday. You're a very ambitious person, aren't you?
Yes.
Where does that originate, do you think?
I think the ambition actually comes from just I love working and I love doing stuff and creating stuff. I work all the time. Sometimes probably to my detriment because I think I don't focus enough on stuff. You know, whenever I'm filming something, I will go off and do a gig in the evening. I never go on holiday, and I'll go away for like a weekend or something, but I can't sit and do nothing. I have to be doing stuff. Every time that I'm not doing that, I feel like it's like time wasted, and I don't know. I feel like it could go away tomorrow, or I could suddenly be out of vogue and not be able to be creating stuff all the time and doing shows.
Given his professional background, being an agent to very, very talented, high-level people, your father, Michael, does he give you advice about your career?
Yeah, he does. He's very helpful. I mean, that's, you know, it's the thing that hurts the most when I read about myself or if I read things on social media. The thing that really hurts is when they're like, oh, he's only got to where he is because of his dad. To become a stand-up comedian, the fact that my dad used to look after Christopher Biggins doesn't necessarily help you get stage time. But that's the bit that really, like, that's the bit that needles me. And I've said it, now that's, people will needle with me more.
Tell me about those first gigs in. So you were at Manchester University and you did your first gigs in Bolton, having done a few little testers when you were at Marlborough College. What was the worst you ever had to put up with? Because I'm not thinking you and the fine people of Bolton are an automatic sort of fit.
Yeah, there was some really terrible gigs when I first started. The worst thing is when there's no audience. No, worse than that is when there's no audience and no mic. So you would literally be stood in the corner of a pub doing your jokes, at which point you just become the madman in the corner of a pub talking at strangers. You need the
and
mic.
Did the madman
get paid?
The mic
gives
you
status.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes you get paid, but... And I always think that's the thing that made me accelerate quite quickly through the sort of stand-up ranks is that I started doing gigs in Manchester, in Bolton, in Wigan, in Warrington, Liverpool, and I had to go on as a posh boy, and that meant that the material had to be pretty good.
What age were you by the time you were financially self-sufficient?
Like quite early on, because I started doing gigs and got quite good, not good, because I still feel like I'm learning, but I...
You're allowed to say good.
No, I can't say good. I can't. I got paid work quite quickly and was doing weekends at, you know, the Comedy Store by the time I was 19, 20.
19.
So since then I've been in work.
Tell me about your next piece of music.
Been pretty...
pretty what?
Oh, it's just like, no struggle, no hardship.
No, I don't think that's fair, has it? You've put yourself up there. You've stood in empty rooms where no one's laughing.
Yeah, actually, it has been pretty tough for me.
Well, you know, define tough, Jack. But yeah, you've paid your dues, haven't you? You've
done
that.
I tried to get into the Beagling Society and they wouldn't let me.
This is a theme. It's time for some more music. Tell me about this. We're on your sixth.
Oh, this is from my favourite film of all time. It's Elton John and Tim Rice, Circle of Life. Now, I told you something before the recording that slightly ruined it for me. And I don't know whether to say it before the song or after the song.
I think you should say it before the song.
And I'm going to ruin this song for everyone. Someone told me that at the beginning it sounds like he's shouting Arsene Wenger. And it's slightly ruined it, but it's still a wonderful song. You didn't enjoy that.
It wouldn't be on my list, but it's your list.
But it's part of my life. If we were doing the movie of my life, that would be the beginning. that song and then Nigel Havers just lifting me up in a dinner jacket on a big rock.
I have to tell our listeners who we heard there. That was Carmen Twilley and Debo M with Circle of Life from the original soundtrack of the film The Lion King. I hope you get the rights. Jack Whitehall, much of your recent work then has centred on this, I called it an unlikely double act of you and your father on screen. You've done a sort of travelogue series for Netflix called Travels with My Father. You've done a talk show called Back Chat. How would you, to somebody maybe who hasn't seen it, how would you describe your on-screen chemistry with your father?
I think what people like about the stuff that I do with my dad is that even though a lot of my life, as we've established on the show, is quite unrelatable, my relationship with him is something that people can recognise a lot of stuff from their relationships with their fathers, and the way we bicker and the way he puts me down and the way I wind him up is very relatable. And, you know, whilst he says glibly that he never wanted it and he doesn't, you know, why am I doing this? He loves it, and I know that he loves it, and I love it.
There are some very, especially in the travelogue series, there are some very tender moments, actually, on camera, where you're surprised by him and he's delighting in you.
Yeah. You can't really plan those, and we don't really talk about our emotions as a family. You're not necessarily very good at that. But it's amazing, you know, the nature of my life. And as I've mentioned, like, I'm working all the time, and I actively choose to do that. That sometimes you sacrifice spending time with people that you care about. And I got very bad at it. I'd come to life when I was, you know, on a show, and I'd be upbeat and fun, and then when I was with them, I was like kind of twitchy and on edge and anxious about work, and I'd see them for an hour for lunch and then bugger off, and I wasn't giving them the best version of myself, and that really upset me. And then I took a conscious effort. I was like, I need to spend more time with them and be careful that I never do that and never take them advantage, because I'm so close to my family and they're so supportive.
There has been, not unsurprisingly, tabloid intrusion in your life, which pretty much comes with the territory. How do your family deal with that?
I mean, the biggest one was when I made a joke about the Queen. It was like a crass joke on a panel show, and it was a joke that I actually regret. And it turned into a kind of Daily Mail confected outrage. It was on the front page every day for like a week. And that was not nice, because it was like something that I'd said caused them upset. And that was the bit that hurt the most. I'm fine. I have a relatively thick skin, but I never want to drag them into it.
And did that take time to repair?
I think I was just became a lot more careful about what I say. I self-censor more.
Let's have some more music, Jack Whitehall. It's your seventh.
This is a song that is in the last show that I wrote, Bounty Hunters. My co-writer is a guy called Freddie Seiborn, and he's one of my best friends, and Freddie has an amazing taste in music, and he's always encouraging me to try and think of songs when we write to put into these scripts. This is a rare occasion where in the room we thought this song would be amazing for the end of an episode, and we wrote it down in the stage directions and it got used, and it also became the song that we listened to when we got writer's block. Hall & Oates, She's Gone.
Sorry, Charlie, for the imposition. I think I got the strength to carry on. Yeah, I need a drink and a quick decision. Now it's up to me. Ooh, what will be? She's gone. She's gone. Oh, I. Oh, I. I better learn how to face. She's gone. She's gone. Oh, I. Oh, I. I pay the devil to replace her. She's gone. And she's gone. Oh, I. What went wrong?
That was Hall & Oates and She's Gone. You've got the Brits coming up soon. You're presenting that. That's a big old monster of a show to present. How are you feeling about that?
Apprehension. If I try to do any joke, then they will not be listening to me. But I'm going into it knowing that. I mean, it's an amazing thing to do. The offices of the Brits, they're in near Waterloo, and I worked on an office above them. And I remember I used to walk past and I was like, oh, I'd love to host that one day. And I am hosting it. So that's why I couldn't really say no to it, even though I might crash and burn on the night.
I am about to cast you away to solitude.
Oh, great.
You'll do fine on the island?
I think I would be terrible on an island. I watched The Island on Channel 4, as I would be the first to leave that. Also, in any kind of situation, I am so blind. I wear contact lenses 5.5 in both eyes. I was like, I would just be dead within the first couple of days.
No,
the minute the contact lenses went, I'm done. So I was tempted to bring contact lenses as my item.
We're doing that in a moment.
Oh,
I'm
sorry,
going to ask you about that in a moment.
I've thought about it so much.
Good. Tell me about your final choice then. What's
oh, yes, we've got the song. Yeah. This was quite a rogue choice. I asked my family. I was like, I'm doing Desert Island Discs, and told some of my friends and family. It was met with utter contempt by most people, like, you're too young to be doing this. Why are you doing Desert Island Discs? So apologies. And I said, what song should I pick? And all of them said this, because I was obsessed as a kid with the chords, but I don't know why.
Was it the beauty of the chords? That, I mean, the music,
yeah,
of course, is perfect.
Jim Corr is a very handsome man, and I think partly the beauty and the beauty of them, but also the beauty of their music. None more so than the Corr's Runaway.
That was the Corrs and Runaway. It's time, Jack, for me now to give you the books. I give everybody the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare.
Thank you.
You get to take one other book along with them.
I'm going to take Nigel Williams's The Wimbledon Poisoner, and it's darkly comic.
We shall give you that.
Thank you.
You're allowed a luxury.
Okay, so my luxury, I gave it loads of thought, and I said the contact lenses, it was maybe going to be those. And then I thought maybe some Crocs, because I hate walking on hot sand.
Other plastic shoes are available.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But in the process of doing this interview, I've realised that there is a glaring omission to my luxury item, and it was obvious all along. So my luxury item will be a dinner jacket, because I want to leave the world as I entered it.
So
full tux.
Full tux.
Black tie. And you'll find me lying on a beach in black tie.
If the waves were to threaten to wash away the discs, which one would be the one that you would run to save?
Oh, it's so hard. Having listened to them all, I think I'm going to go with Nat King Cole, Let There Be Love. Sat on a beach in a dinner jacket listening to Let There Be Love.
Michael will be very proud. Jack Whitehall, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs. You'll find over 2,000 interviews with artists, musicians, scientists, sports stars, comedians and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs. And I have a favour to ask. If you could rate and review the Desert Island Discs podcast wherever you download your podcasts, it'll really help other people find us. Thanks again for listening.
This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Jenny Murray.
And I'm Jane Garvey.
And we wanted to let you know about another podcast you might enjoy.
You can download the Woman's Hour podcast right now and hear great stuff like this.
I'll tell you something, though. This will never happen again, because there's precipitated by Harvey Weinstein is a network now of women who speak to each other.
It's the podcast about women,
but made for everyone.
With arts and culture,
to sport and politics.
You're sure to find something to enjoy and to make you think.
So download the Woman's Hour podcast now. It doesn't cost you anything. Well, go on, what are you waiting for?